Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
It's Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. I'm Eli Portillo, in for Mike Collins. Today on Politics Monday, it's Indigenous Peoples Day, and we're going to explore some of the issues on Native American voters' minds, as well as the broader trends in voter access affecting this numerically small but potentially quite significant group. In an electoral environment where races are determined by fractions of a percentage point, this often overlooked voter bloc could be a difference maker this year. That's why we're seeing both campaigns reaching out to Native American communities in battleground states, including here. But Native American voters weren't a group that politicians always chased. In fact, for a majority of their time in the U.S., people fought to keep Native American voters away from the polls and keep the ballot out of their hands. And access to the ballot is still an ongoing issue. Joining me now to talk about all this and more are Sarah Nagum, editor of the Border Belt Independent, and Jesslyn Kazaya, executive director of the Triangle Native American Society and a member of the Lumbee Tribe. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I also wanted to just note that we did have a couple other guests who were scheduled to be on the show, but unfortunately, due to family emergency circumstances and illness circumstances, they were not able to join us. But we are going to power through and explore this rich issue on Indigenous Peoples Day. So just to start, I'm going to just throw a few statistics out and talk about the Native American community here in Charlotte. In the Charlotte region and in North Carolina more broadly. A lot of people might not know this, but North Carolina actually has the largest percentage of Native American residents of any state east of the Mississippi. That's about 3% of the population versus a little over 1% nationwide. There are 8 recognized tribes in North Carolina, including the Eastern Band of Cherokees and the Lumbee. And obviously, we're not talking about the largest group in numerical terms, but like I said, in a state that Donald Trump won by about a little more than a percentage point in 2020, there is a big effort to get Native voters and get them interested in supporting both campaigns. So let's talk, before we turn to the current election, about the history of Native voting rights. It's the 100th anniversary this year of the federal law that conferred birthright citizenship on Native Americans, which I actually did not know that that was so recent until I started prepping for this show. Jesslyn, is that common that people don't know how recent full legal citizenship as an automatic right is?
Yeah, absolutely. I find that it's really surprising what most folks don't know. And then when you think about it a little deeper, it's not very surprising because we are not often taught about accurate information about the history of Native people, including recent and contemporary information. You'll even see a number of our young people have started businesses and making t-shirts. And one common phrase is, we are still here, because we often find that people don't even recognize that there are Native American people still living here widely around. I will say after 2016, around the time of the Standing Rock protests, we have seen more visibility for Native people nationwide, and we're seeing visibility really increase. But invisibility is something that our community has been fighting from the history of colonization and just the ways that information about our community has been suppressed through dominant narratives and even through the education system. I was in grad school before, in my 30s, before I had a piece of paper slid. One professor put a map of the tribes of North Carolina in front of us. And that was the first time I had ever had accurate information presented to me in the classroom as a Native person of North Carolina. So it's surprising. It is surprising what people don't know, but I'll say, yeah, it's very common.
And with the history of voting rights, you know, once birthright citizenship was conferred by law in 1924, discrimination didn't end there. This is from a USA Today story about the 100-year anniversary and how voting discrimination continued past that. Utah considered anyone living on tribal lands non-residents and ineligible to vote. Other states, including Arizona, barred people under guardianship from registering to vote and used a court case that likened the relationship between tribal nations and the U.S. to that of a ward to his guardian to enforce a voting ban against Native Americans. And that continued until the Voting Rights Act passed in the 60s. What kind of barriers have Native Americans faced in North Carolina in accessing the ballot, and what do those barriers look like in the present time?
So I'll share here. I think, you know, we see different political games in different parts of the country. And so what you're talking about is true. Even though we had the Native Citizenship Act of 1924, here in the South, we were facing Jim Crow, of course. On other parts of the country, there were, you know, more state-specific laws or policies that may have suppressed voting rights. So we actually hear about many communities gaining more rights around the time of the 60s. So even though we're celebrating 100 years of the Native vote, technically, on paper, in many communities, that's still those rights still didn't come to the forefront. In the most recent elections, we've seen, I would say, very specific barriers depending on the area that you're living in. Out west, in the last couple of elections, we've seen more of the reservation-based tribes who had many challenges with voter ID laws changing, with access to polling locations changing. Here in North Carolina, we know that what we faced is gerrymandering that went to the Supreme Court. And the quote was that North Carolina was gerrymandered with surgical precision. So we see the way that the maps are drawn, the way that the polling locations are laid out, the way the information gets out, what we're finding. So we're a nonpartisan organization, and we are focusing a lot on Get Out the Native Vote through a project called Democracy is Indigenous, supported by the National Urban Indian Family Coalition. So we're working with folks all over the country who are trying to get out the Native vote. And what we see here in North Carolina is that as ID laws have changed, as early voting information has changed slightly from how it's been in the past, we're really focusing on getting that accurate information so that folks know how to find their polling location, know how to get accurate information on the candidates that are on their ballot, what's on your ballot, who's on your ballot, what to expect when you actually show up, knowing that a tribal ID is a accepted ID to be able to vote in elections. What I also find is that a lot of times there's teaching up that needs to happen at the polls, where I've carried my tribal ID along with my driver's license, right, or other forms of identification to the polls to fly. I have been questioned before on whether the ID is legitimate. People have never seen a tribal ID before. And so I think there may be some degree of training or awareness that could be helpful there to make sure that people can have their vote count when they go.
And one thing you mentioned that I think is important to note is that the history of Native American access to the ballot and the right to vote is intertwined with many other groups' fights for voting access. And when it comes to Native identity, one thing I've learned is that there are many people who, have more than one identity, especially in North Carolina, who have mixed ancestry. Sarah, I know that for the Border Belt Independent, you spent a lot of time reporting on and editing stories about the history of racism and discrimination in southeastern North Carolina. How do those fights relate, and how do the people you've interviewed and lived among talk about the intertwining battle for rights among people who are, you know, from different groups?
Yeah, you know, as Jesslyn said, indigenous people face much of the same discrimination during Jim Crow as Black residents, right? In Robeson County, you know, the hospital in Lumberton, there was a white wing, a Black wing, and a Native American wing. There were separate areas of the movie theater. There were separate water fountains, three separate water fountains. And I think that's a history that we are just not taught much about in America, which is really unfortunate. And you're right, Robeson County is one of the most diverse counties in America. The Lumbee tribe, of course, and Jesslyn would be the expert on this, descend from several Native American tribes who settled along the Lumber River in Robeson County. But yeah, they identify as Lumbee, and they still face much of the same discrimination, to be honest with you. And in terms of barriers to voting today, Robeson County has historically had low voter turnout. In 2016, voter turnout in Robeson was only 62%. That compares to 75% statewide. 2016, it was even lower, 54%. But that was after Hurricane Matthew, which devastated Robeson County, which, of course, we might see that now in the western part of the state this year. But as you said, Eli, this is a very important voter block in North Carolina, and the voter turnout has been historically low. And I think so much, this election could hinge on the Native American get out the vote efforts.
Yeah, and I know there's been a lot of attention paid and even some national coverage of get out the vote efforts and the community in Arizona in particular. Maybe a little less attention paid in North Carolina, but no less a chance of swinging the election. Before we turn to the current election, I did want to just spend a moment talking about kind of the history in North Carolina. And Sarah, I know that you've lived in Robeson County. Of course, you continue to work and report on the area. And Jesslyn, you also mentioned uncovering things in the past that you weren't taught in school. I'm curious for both of you, has learning about the history of Native voting access and discrimination, has that been surprising as you've grown and aged and learned more?
Absolutely. I grew up in West Virginia, and I don't remember a single history class growing up where we were taught this stuff. And it's really sad, and it's really unfortunate. And it wasn't until I started covering Robeson County that I learned so much again about the Jim Crow era and how Native Americans were affected. Native Americans were enslaved along with Black residents. So yeah, it was an eye-opening experience for me, and I think it would be for most people.
And Jesslyn?
Yeah, I'll share. For me, unfortunately, I don't think it ever truly felt surprising. It felt really par for the course, just in this. I actually grew up in Union County, so I'm local around the area where we're speaking right now. And being one of the only Lumbee people, one of the only Native people in many of my classes, I found that just through my family, I knew some of our history that was not being represented in our textbooks. And I know we're coming up on a break, but I'd love to come back into the details of some of that.
Yes, we will be back in just about 90 seconds and we'll return to those details. I'm Eli Portillo on Charlotte Talks today, Indigenous Peoples Day. We are talking about the history of Native American voting and the 2024 election.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.
It's Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. I'm Eli Portillo, in for Mike Collins, and this hour on Politics Monday, and also Indigenous Peoples Day, we are exploring the history of Native American voting access in North Carolina and the country. and the 2024 election and what is on the minds of Native American voters in North Carolina. I'm joined by Sarah Nagum, editor of the Border Belt Independent, and Jesslyn Kazaya, executive director of the Triangle Native American Society, who was just talking about growing up outside Charlotte in Union County. And you were talking about what it was like and some of the experiences being the only Native person in many of your classes, and I wanted to return to that.
Yeah, and we were talking about what's surprising of what people know and what's not surprising. So unfortunately, I haven't been surprised by the lack of information, and I'm often not surprised by the exclusion of Native voices or attention to Native issues. And so it's really interesting because I grew up in an Indian Trail. And was even surprised, even just in the name of Indian Trail, right? There's a huge history there in the trading path all the way through North Carolina. And if you look at many of our trading paths historically, they now have become these areas that are now major interstates and thoroughfares. So we're still using these trading paths today, even if we recognize them by different names. And so I will say that there are some great sources of information in history and with voting rights and rights specifically. Melinda Maynor Lowry is one of our Lumbee historians and author, filmmaker, documentarian, really amazing woman in general. She wrote not only the Lumbee Indians, our collective history of the tribe, but also Lumbee Indians in the Jim Crow South that really details out specifically how those policies played out here locally in our area, because as Sarah was mentioning, Robeson County was really unique even across the country in how some of these policies played out. I will say that I just this last weekend went to a Native women's gathering for the Cultural Burn Association, which is newly started and helping to bring fire back into the ecosystem. We know so many of our ecosystems here, longleaf pine landscapes, are dependent on fire, healthy fire, right, to help activate some of those seeds. And Robeson County is also an area where wildfires really have taken off. And so bringing healthy fire into the landscape to prevent those big disasters. The reason I'm saying this is because there was a woman there from Minnesota, from one of the tribes out in Minnesota, who had come in to join us. And she said, you know, it's really interesting because all of y'all that I talk to in North Carolina, all the Native people in North Carolina that I talk to really know your history, you know, and all the Lumbee women that I'm talking to specifically, you really know a lot about the history and the policies and the everything that's been affecting your people all the way up until the current moment. And I really appreciated that she said that. And it also really made me reflect because my response to her was that we have been questioned for so long that our community really has had to know our history, to know the course of how everything has played out around us in order to be able to explain the Lumbee tribe in particular, the ways that we're questioned locally and nationwide. We really have to dig into that history. And so we find that people are very active, very engaged. You were talking about the small percentage, but we are a swing vote in a swing state. We always have been. We've seen that in the last couple elections, a huge swing vote. Even the Lumbee tribe in particular, huge swing vote, but also all of our tribal communities in general. We're seeing more attention. We're seeing more pandering in some places, right? Where we're like, oh, wow, you know, these folks have never showed up into our community before. And then all of a sudden, you know, here it is election season and folks are coming out of the woodwork trying to reach out, build partnerships. I would say for anyone really looking to authentically build a partnership, you know, doing it outside of these high pressure moments makes a much bigger impact. But it's no surprise to me that we see this attention coming down.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit and what you are seeing in terms of outreach from the campaigns. In 2020, the last presidential election, Native American turnout statewide was 63% in North Carolina. And of the single ethnicity groups that the state tracks, that is the lowest, lower than all of the groups except Hispanic Latino, which is a little bit different because they classify that as an ethnicity. But what do you find that folks are doing to try to increase that participation and connect with those communities. I understand that there has been, even more on the ground outreach, like opening campaign offices and opening party offices. What kind of outreach are you seeing?
Yeah, so the Republican National Convention opened an office in downtown Pembroke in Robeson County in 2022. That was a really big deal. You know, they, Robeson County had clearly swung to the right, and they really, really wanted to capitalize on that and say, we don't want this to be a one-time thing. We want to keep Robeson County red, which would have been unimaginable a decade earlier, right? So you saw this big swing. Now, it should be noted, Kamala Harris also opened an office in Robeson County over the summer. But what I will say is that we've talked to a lot of voters in Robeson, Scotland County, which also has a high percentage of Native Americans. One theme that we hear over and over again is that they want candidates to show up. They will vote for candidates who show up and see them and talk to them. You know, Donald Trump held a rally 2 weeks before the election in 2020, and he won. I actually have the data right here. He held the rally a couple weeks before the election and just won by, 10 points in the county after that. Barack Obama had won Robeson County in 2008 and 2012. So him showing up clearly made a difference. Now, of course, he was in Wilmington last month saying he will, get full federal recognition for the Lumbee. Of course, he can't do that unilaterally. That would take an act of Congress. But Kamala Harris has also said that she supports full federal recognition for the Lumbee. So did Barack Obama. So did Joe Biden. But to Jesslyn's point about the pandering, we're seeing that a lot. And, federal recognition for the Lumbee has become this election point that I feel like maybe gets misrepresented, because every candidate they all say that they support full federal recognition for the Lumbee. But Trump, I think, has really capitalized on that. And that has that's made a difference for a lot of voters in Robeson County. He shows up and they really appreciate that from what I hear from them.
Yep. And I think we actually have audio of former President Trump from that rally. Let's hear what he had to say about full federal recognition.
Tell him Biden and Obama promised remedy, that they want to remedy the injustice, but they never did it. They broke their promise. And today I'm officially announcing that if I am elected in November, I will sign legislation granting the great Lumbee tribe the federal recognition that it deserves. Okay? You'll be all set. Say hello to them. And I got to know them. They're great. But unfortunately, we weren't in office when that happened. But they treated him very badly. Thank you very much, John.
And Vice President Kamala Harris has also said she supports full federal recognition. Let's dig into that issue a little bit, because it's important, I think, to understand what that means in order to understand the Lumbee tribe's position and what's at stake. What does full federal recognition entail that the tribe currently does not enjoy with its, I guess you could call it, partially recognized status?
Yeah, and Sarah, I'm happy to speak to that.
Sure. No, go ahead.
Yeah, so the Lumbee tribe, we're in a really unique position among all tribes in the nation. And so to back up a little bit, federal recognition status, state recognition status, now we're starting to delve into Indian law, which is its own whole branch of understanding law and policy as it relates to tribal nations. So we know that tribes are kinship communities and also are nations, right? Are their own self-sustaining governments, governing bodies to their own people. So we have elections, we have a officials who represented our communities as dignitaries and bridge that government-to-government relationship between the tribal nation and the federal government, the state government, local governments. So that's just a really important baseline that I find many people don't have awareness around how that works if you're outside of Native community. So federal recognition is a process that goes through the federal government. It is literally an act of Congress that in our case granted what we talk about as partial federal recognition or federal recognition in name only. So when the Lumbee Act, this has been a process that's been going on since the 1800s, right? So there's deep history here, more than what we can really go into. But the Lumbee Act that passed in 1956 recognized the tribe as a Native American tribe, recognized us in name only, and in the same piece of legislation denied us access to the benefits and the rights that come along with that. The reason and the context for that is during the 50s, we were in what was known as the era of termination in Congress's history on policy towards tribal nations. So they were actually cutting the benefits of many tribal nations, terminating tribes, meaning wiping their rights out from legislation. And so by the time that our legislation actually made its way up and through Congress, they were in this area of terminating rights. We were not terminated as a tribe. Our rights were not terminated. However, we were recognized in name only and denied access to those resources. This puts us in a unique position relative to any other tribe in the nation is not in the exact same position that we are with this legislation. So it's not as simple as granting that recognition status. It's not as simple as going through the Bureau of Indian Affairs recognition process. The only thing that can modify this is a act of Congress updating that legislation that was written in 1956. And so that's where today we're in the process of the Lumbee Fairness Act. I really appreciate hearing both of y'all using this language of full federal recognition, right? Recognizing that we have been recognized in name only, and now it's a matter of correcting that injustice so that we're recognized fully in a way that comes with the rights and benefits that come along with that. So the Lumbee Fairness Act is something that's come up to Congress. You know, we found that it's passed in one and never made its way to the floor in the other many times. I think it's like 11 times over the most recent year. Sarah may have more statistics on that. And I'll say I'm not an expert in this area of federal Indian law and policy, but this is something that's really important that's affected our community. There are other tribes in North Carolina that are also in the process of seeking federal recognition. What I'll also say, because we do work nationwide with other tribal nations and our urban Indian organizations nationwide, and even the National Congress of American Indians, which is coming up at the end of the month. We send folks every year. This is a big point of conversation there. North Carolina is very unique because of our large Native community and how tight-knit our communities are, very intertribal. We share a lot of resources, spend a lot of time together. Between leaders among the tribal communities. We have a Commission of Indian Affairs that is that's set up in a really beautiful way and provides a lot of great resources out to our tribes and functions as that arm to bridge that government-to-government relationship between the tribes and the state. Not every state, I've learned, you know, I grew up thinking kind of that's the way it was. Not every state has as good of a setup at the state level as we do. So our state recognition process, and we do have 8 state recognized tribes. Our state recognition process is very stringent and very, very rigorous. And so the Commission of Indian Affairs handles a lot of that. And I know you spoke some of their names. It's very important to me that we speak the names of all of our tribes, and so that folks know who is here and also know the correct pronunciations and, you know, get to know their neighbors if you're not already familiar. It is powwow season. There's a powwow about every weekend. I really encourage folks to go out. Powwows are open to the public and meant to be a place of cultural exchange. So I really encourage folks to get out there.
Yeah, to put you on the spot a little bit, can you speak their names? Because
absolutely.
I had the full list in front of me, and then at the last second, I got scared about pronunciation, so I just did the first two.
Yes. And so that's why I think it's so important to speak our names. And oftentimes when I'm speaking in front of audiences, I'll have folks repeat them aloud. So listeners out there, If you want to get comfortable with these words in your mouth, you know, please speak the names of the tribes aloud, and let's honor our people who are here. So in the far west, and we send our hearts out to all of our folks who are affected by Helene. We also have family members and community members up there. Up in the west, we have the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians, the Eastern Band. There are three bands of Cherokee. Eastern Band here in Western North Carolina are our local folks. Down in Sampson and Harnett County, we have the Coharie. The Coharie have been doing an Raising River initiative in the last couple of years. I know they're just through with harvesting their annual sorghum harvest this year, which is a bumper crop. Yeah, we love our folks down in Coharie. Just south of there is my people, the Lumbee, around Robeson County, Hoke, Scotland, Cumberland. The Lumbee, we are the ninth largest tribe in the nation and the largest east of the Mississippi by far, with about 55,000 enrolled members. Up in Halifax and Warren County, we have the Halawasapony. Our Halawasapony folks, I know, had a great Indigenous Peoples Day celebration yesterday, so congratulations on that beautiful event. Up in Person County, we have the Saponi. Up in the High Plains community. Out towards Ahoskie, we have the Maharan, and I believe the Maharan just got their historical marker placed. It might have been this past weekend or the last weekend. All of the tribes are getting historical markers placed right now. Up here in Orange County and Alamance County, we have the Okanichi Band of Saponi Nation. And then out in Columbus and Bladen County around Lake Waccamaw, we have the People of the Falling Star, as they're known, the Waccamaw Suwan. So that's our eight recognized tribes. We also have four urban Indian organizations because we know that about 77% of Native people actually live in urban areas. So around your area, we have Metrolina Native American Association. Towards Fayetteville, there's Cumberland County Association for Indian People. Up in Guilford Native American Association. And here in the Triangle, we are Triangle Native American Society. So if you are a urban Native person living in one of those areas, definitely please reach out to these organizations.
Thank you for that. And again, thank you for the pronunciations and the information. It is Politics Monday, so we're going to have to talk a little bit more about politics when we come back. Although, to be honest, excuse me, I would maybe rather focus on the history. But hey, we got to do what we got to do. So I'm Eli Portillo in from Mike Collins. You are listening to Charlotte Talks here on 90.7 WFAE. It is Indigenous Peoples Day, and we are spending this hour focused on the history of Indigenous folks and voting in North Carolina, as well as some of the issues with elections and ballot access. We'll be right back.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
It's Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. I'm Eli Portillo, in today for Mike Collins. I'm joined by Sarah Nagem of the Border Belt Independent and Jesselyn Kazaya of the Triangle Native American Society and a citizen of the Lumbee Tribe. We are talking today about, on Indigenous Peoples Day, about the history and current issues around Native American voters in North Carolina. So, Sarah, one thing that has been a really big news story, I think, not just here in North Carolina, but even gotten some national coverage, is the rightward shift of many voters in Robeson County, where the Lumbee Nation is concentrated. You know, historically, this was, I think, the heart of Democrats' strength in rural North Carolina, really. The bluest of blue counties for generations. But that started to shift. In 2016, Robeson County went red for the first time in, oh gosh, I don't know, perhaps ever, but certainly in the modern era. Donald Trump won just over 50% of the vote there. And then in 2020, he won about 59% of the vote. So what have you found in talking with voters in Robeson County and the region is driving that shift?
Yeah, I think what's driving the shift is is a lot of the same things that's driving the shift in rural America in general. You know, I think that a lot of people that we talk to in Robeson County say that they have conservative views on abortion, sometimes on LGBTQ rights, more socially conservative, I would say. And they point to those issues as being immigration, would be another one. They point to those issues as being top of mind for them. And they say that Trump, a lot of people, I never want to lump a group of people together, right? There's so much nuance. But a lot of people we talk to say that Trump better aligns with those views, with those socially conservative views. And you're right, you know, Robeson County was a huge Democratic stronghold for so long. And what folks are saying is that the Democratic Party no longer represents them, no longer shows up for them, no longer represents their values, which, of course, is what we're hearing across much of rural America.
Yeah. And,
you know, if I could just
go
add,
ahead, please.
You know, and thank you for correcting me. I said Trump won Robeson by about 10 points in 2020. He actually won by 19 points. So, you know, it was just a steal. But, you know, Lumbee, full federal recognition for the Lumbee was always seen as a Democrat issue, you know, back early on and for many decades. It has really become a bipartisan issue. Senator Richard Burr, a Republican, said in 2022 that about 30 bills for full federal recognition have been filed in the past 35-ish years, split just about evenly between Democrats and Republicans. So we've seen that shift where more Republicans are supporting full federal recognition for the Lumbee. And, you know, we could, you know, sort of talk about what that might be, whether, you know, they wanted to cater to the Lumbee vote or sort of the dynamics of that. But it has become much more of a bipartisan issue.
And although, you know, Robeson County and the surrounding areas are not numerically the largest, you know, you've got more than 1 million people in Mecklenburg County, for example, there is something really important, especially in close elections, about piling up those big margins and neutralizing the other side's ability to pile up those margins wherever you can. And, you know, we've had a state Supreme Court race decided by fewer than 500 votes here in North Carolina. So there's really a lot of scrapping and scraping for those votes in rural North Carolina. How?
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, please.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, I don't think Kamala Harris's campaign thinks that they're going to win Robeson County. That, you know, the 2024 is not going to be the year that Robeson County turns blue again. What the campaign wants to do is chisel away at that margin, because you're right. We are talking about slim margins that will decide this election.
And when you look at what the campaigns are doing to try to chisel away those margins, or in the Republicans' case, to build on them and pile them up, you mentioned the offices they've opened, showing up. How much of this comes down to maybe the Democrats having taken for granted for a long time this corner of the state, and the other side being willing to show up and make the effort?
I think that's a huge part of it. And we hear that from so many people. People have got to, you know, candidates have got to show up. They have got to show up. And I'd love to hear Jesslyn's perspective on that, you know, as a member of the Lumbee tribe.
Yeah. Have you seen, you know, people saying, hey, you know, for a long time, people just assumed we would vote one way no matter what. And hey, it turns out that, you know, we are actually persuadable, and when people show up, it makes a difference. And I believe you're on mute. Excuse me. There you
Thank
go.
Thank you. Yeah, I've definitely seen for a long time. It seems like this feeling of being left out, of being passed over, or you know, other other communities' issues really rising up. So I do think that the on-the-ground presence in the last couple of years, you know, I have seen that make a big difference just in terms of what people are talking about. What I also see is a really deep divide in the community. And we're talking about a swing vote. You know, obviously, we really saw that swing in one direction in this last election. I see really deep generational shifts in perception and opinion. And I see a really rigorous debate, I'll call it that, happening within community. So to me, what I'm seeing is maybe more recognizing that we are now being reached out to, right? And we and our issues are coming onto the table. And so after these years of invisibility, that visibility really makes a difference on the ground in how people are perceiving their own role in this election. And so I think we now have an awareness of being a really powerful vote, of being that swing vote in a swing state. You know, and we've seen the trends and how that's played out in the past, and it'll be really interesting to see how that plays out in these next coming years.
Well, State Representative Jared Lowry, who is a Republican from Robeson County, he was on WUNC's politics podcast, I believe, last fall, and he talked about the role of economic and kitchen table issues, so to speak, in many voters' lives, trying to stress, I think, that, you know, the Lumbee folks are not a single issue, you know, federal recognition is all we care about group. Mm-hmm. Let's hear what he had to say.
It has had a major effect on a lot of families. You know, I remember growing up, you know, there was a lot of factories here, you know, had Abbott Laboratories making medical supplies, hospital supplies. You had Converse making shoes. There was companies making golf balls. There was all kinds of different things. And people would talk about the things that they made at work, and they'd be very, very proud of that. You know, I remember, you know, going to the hospital. My grandfather was in the hospital. My mom worked at Abbott Laboratories, and she'd pull me over to the side. She'd say, hey, you see that? Like, we make that. Like, I make that. There was a lot of pride in that. And a lot of that's gone.
So what role do these economic issues have in the Native American community's vote? What are you hearing from voters about what matters to them when it comes to issues around the pocketbook?
Yeah, you know, Southeastern North Carolina is struggling, and it's been struggling for a long time, right? The loss of tobacco, the loss of manufacturing. Neighboring Scotland County, neighboring to Robeson, has, again, one of the highest percentages of Native Americans in the state, has the highest unemployment rate in the state, and does so consistently. It's hard down there, right? It's tough to make a living. It's tough to find a job. And again, I think that so many voters are frustrated, they're tired, and I think struggling economically has really contributed to a sense of apathy that no matter who I vote for, nothing's going to get better. You know, they are not going to do anything to improve the economy here. And that's what I'm hearing a lot from voters.
And Jesselyn, what's your take on that?
Yeah, I'll be honest with you. I have so many thoughts. They're all scrambling around in there. First, I'll say that what Sarah just said about, you know, no matter who I vote for, right, that we may be in the same circumstances. And I will say I have definitely heard sentiments like that. And I've also heard just a real strong self-reliance, right, that it isn't going to be people from outside who come and really change or save or boost what's happening on the ground, but it's going to be ourselves and our own resilience and our own community. I'll say also that I hear a lot of folks, and especially having this nationwide attention on Robeson County, on the Lumbee Tribe, I hear a lot of talking down about Robeson County. I hear a lot of focusing on the problems and the challenges. And to me, that's leaving out a really big part of the conversation, which is that our people have been so incredible at how resilient we've been able to be, how we've been able to survive, as Sarah mentioned earlier, the many communities that came together in order to survive and become out of different communities, the Lumbee people today. We have always been very self-reliant and have always helped our neighbors. And so you see that real strong local dedication, even when we feel like maybe we're being left out of the bigger conversation or looked down upon from the outside. So I will always stand up for my people and for our area, in that we have a huge amount of strengths and we should be really focusing on that strengths-based conversation of what we have that's so unique, because it is such a unique, really powerful and resilient area. I'll also say to the bipartisan, and I don't tend to be a partisan person, or I do tend to be a partisan person. However, wearing this hat, I am working in a very nonpartisan, 501c3 nonprofit organization. So wearing this hat, I will speak really in this nonpartisan way, and also share that what you're speaking about the bipartisan effort around recognition, and about even beyond the Lumbee tribe, Native issues in general, we are seeing more bipartisan support. And I think that's a really positive thing. I'm really encouraged to see. I don't think it should ever become something that's so partisan when we're talking about people's basic rights and humanity, right? And so it's been really beautiful to see the working together that's happening from both sides of the aisle. What I'll also share is that I do see a lot of folks who have the opinion that, no matter who's in power, that power is going to keep changing. However, as Indigenous people, we will always be here. We have always been here. We will always be here. Our dedication to the community is the same. The issues tend to remain about the same. So no matter who's in power, we have to find a way to work with them to build that relationship in the long term, so that it's not so dependent on these swings. And so that's where I'm focusing a lot of my time and effort, community effort. I will commend Representative Lowry. He's been really supportive. He's also the brother of our tribal chairman, John Lowry. To my knowledge, even within many of our families, we have political divides, and we find this way to love each other and work with each other no matter what. So I'm really encouraged to see that bipartisan effort, and I hope we see that build in the years to come. I think the political divide feels like it's widening so often, and I think we can get ourselves in trouble when we start to see our neighbors as the other, right? And start to lean into that divide. I think we need to find our way back to each other and back to supporting each other for what really matters, and just taking care of our neighbors, plain and simple as that.
And what is at stake for the Native American communities that you either report on and know, Sarah, or belong to, Jesselyn, in this election? What do you view as being at stake for those communities?
Wow, that's a great question. So much is at stake, right? I think that, as Jesselyn said, there is such a huge divide. And I think that maybe efforts to bridge that divide are at stake, right? And I know there's disagreement about, what's causing the divisiveness or who's causing the divisiveness. But I think that, maybe personally for folks, maybe that's at stake. Politically, what's at stake might be, the Democrats' ability to ever win back Robeson County, to ever make inroads again in that part of North Carolina. And, there's been this push to focus on rural North Carolina, and we'll, for Democrats to focus on rural North Carolina. And I guess we will see in November how successful those efforts will have proved to be.
And Jesselyn?
Yeah, I think there's so many things at stake, not just in this election, but at this, it seems like we're really in a turning point in our collective lives, as humanity. And I think that getting at each other's throats is not going to be what gets us to the end in a caring way. So I hope that folks are really thinking about their interests long term in their community and truly voting for their interests of, what is going to provide my community stability and success over time. I will also share, as Indigenous people, we are defined by our tie to the land. And so I think, that is something that always needs to come up in the conversation. conversation, the land, the environment, the water. All of our tribal communities are situated around water. We are fishing people. We're an agricultural people. So these issues of land, environment, are also really critical. We've already talked about the economic details. That's also a really critical piece. So I think it's a matter of balancing our interests truly in the long term.
Well, Jesslyn Kazaya, Executive Director of the Triangle Native American Society and a citizen of the Lumbee Nation, Sarah Nagem, editor of the Border Belt Independent, thank you both for joining us on Charlotte Talks this hour. I'm Eli Portillo, in for Mike Collins. Again, it is Indigenous Peoples Day, so I encourage everyone who's listening to get out and learn something about the history of Indigenous people in this state.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.